Chapter 19. What happened to them at Suriname, and how Candide got acquainted with Martin. Our travellers spent the first day very agreeably. They were delighted with possessing more treasure than all Asia, Europe, and Africa could scrape together. Candide, in his raptures, cut Cunegonde's name on the trees. The second day, two of their sheep plunged into a morass where they and their burdens were lost. Two more died of fatigue a few days after. Seven or eight perished with hunger in a desert, and others subsequently fell down precipices. At length, after travelling 100 days, only two sheep remained. Said Candide to Cacambo, "My friend, if you see how perishable are the riches of this world, there is nothing solid but virtue, and the happiness of seeing Cunegonde once more."
"Ah, I grant all you say," said Cacambo, "but we have still two sheep remaining, with more treasure than the King of Spain will ever have, and I see a town which I take to be Suriname, belonging to the Dutch. We are at the end of all our troubles, and at the beginning of happiness."
As they drew near the town, they saw a negro stretched upon the ground, with only one moiety of his clothes, that is, of his blue linen drawers. The poor man had lost his left leg and his right hand.
"Good God!" said Candide in Dutch. "What art thou doing there, friend, in that shocking condition?"
"I am waiting for my master, Mynheer Vanderdendur, the famous merchant," answered the negro.
"Ah, oh, was it Mynheer Vanderdendur," said Candide, "that treated thee thus?"
"Yes, sir," said the negro. "It is the custom. They give us a pair of linen drawers for our whole garment twice a year. When we work at the sugar canes, and the mill snatches hold of a finger, they cut off the hand. And when we attempt to run away, they cut off the leg. Both cases have happened to me. This is the price at which you eat sugar in Europe. Yet when my mother sold me for 10 patagons on the coast of Guinea, she said to me, 'My dear child, bless our fetishes, adore them forever. They will make thee live happily. Thou hast the honour of being the slave of our lords, the whites, which is making the fortune of thy father and mother.' Alas, I know not whether I have made their fortunes. This I know, that they have not made mine. Dogs, monkeys, and parrots are 1,000 times less wretched than I. The Dutch fetishes, who have converted me, declare every Sunday that we are all of us children of Adam, blacks as well as whites. I am not a genealogist, but if these preachers tell truth, we are all second cousins. Now, you must agree that it is impossible to treat one's relations in a more barbarous manner."
"Oh, Pangloss," cried Candide, "thou hadst not guessed at this abomination. It is the end. I must at last renounce thy optimism."
"Well, what is optimism?" said Cacambo.
"Alas," said Candide, "it is the madness of maintaining that everything is right when it is wrong."
Looking at the negro, he shed tears, and weeping, he entered Suriname. The first thing they inquired after was whether there was a vessel in the harbour which could be sent to Buenos Aires. The person to whom they applied was a Spanish sea captain, who offered to agree with them upon reasonable terms. He appointed to meet them at a public house, whither Candide and the faithful Cacambo went with their two sheep, and awaited his coming. Candide, who had his heart upon his lips, told the Spaniard all his adventures, and avowed that he intended to elope with Miss Cunegonde.
"Oh, then I will take good care not to carry you to Buenos Aires," said the seaman. "I should be hanged, and so will you. The fair Cunegonde is my lord's favourite mistress."
This was a thunderclap for Candide. He wept for a long while. At last he drew Cacambo aside.
"Here, my dear friend," said he to him, "this thou must do. We have, each of us in his pocket, 5 or 6 millions in diamonds. You are more clever than I. You must go and bring Miss Cunegonde from Buenos Aires. If the governor makes any difficulty, give him 1 million. If he will not relinquish her, give him 2. As you have not killed an inquisitor, they will have no suspicion of you. I'll get another ship, and go and wait for you at Venice. Now, that's a free country, where there is no danger either from Bulgarians, Abares, Jews, or inquisitors."
Cacambo applauded this wise resolution. He despaired at parting from so good a master, who had become his intimate friend, but the pleasure of serving him prevailed over the pain of leaving him. They embraced with tears. Candide charged him not to forget the good old woman. Cacambo set out that very same day. This Cacambo was a very honest fellow. Candide stayed some time longer in Suriname, waiting for another captain to carry him and the two remaining sheep to Italy. After he had hired domestics and purchased everything necessary for a long voyage, Mynheer van der Dendur, captain of a large vessel, came and offered his services. "How much will you charge," said he to this man, "to carry me straight to Venice, me, my servants, my baggage, and these two sheep?" The skipper asked 10,000 piastres. Candide did not hesitate. "Oho!" said the prudent van der Dendur to himself. "This stranger gives 10,000 piastres unhesitatingly. He must be very rich." Returning a little while after, he let him know that upon second consideration he could not undertake the voyage for less than 20,000 piastres. "Well, you shall have them," said Candide. "Well," said the skipper to himself, "this man agrees to pay 20,000 piastres with as much ease as 10." He went back to him again, and declared that he could not carry him to Venice for less than 30,000 piastres. "Then you shall have 30,000, replied Candide. Said the Dutch skipper once more to himself. 30,000 piastres are a trifle to this man. Surely these sheep must be laden with an immense treasure. Let us say no more about it. First of all, let him pay down the 30,000 piastres, and then we shall see." Candide sold two small diamonds, the least of which was worth more than what the skipper asked for his freight. He paid him in advance. The two sheep were put on board. Candide followed in a little boat to join the vessel which was riding at anchor. The skipper seized his opportunity, set sail, and put out to sea, the wind favouring him. Candide, dismayed and stupefied, soon lost sight of the vessel. "Alas," said he, "this is a trick worthy of the old world." He put back, overwhelmed with sorrow, for indeed he had lost sufficient to make the fortune of 20 monarchs. He waited upon the Dutch magistrate, and in his distress he knocked over loudly at the door. He entered and told his adventure, raising his voice with unnecessary vehemence. The magistrate began by fining him 10,000 piastres for making a noise. Then he listened patiently, promised to examine into his affair at the skipper's return, and ordered him to pay 10,000 piastres for the expense of the hearing. This drove Candide to despair. He had indeed endured misfortunes 1,000 times worse. The coolness of the magistrate and of the skipper who had robbed him roused his choler and flung him into a deep melancholy. The villainy of mankind presented itself before his imagination in all its deformity, and his mind was filled with gloomy ideas. At length, hearing that a French vessel was ready to set sail for Bordeaux, and as he had no sheep laden with diamonds to take along with him, he hired a cabin at the usual price. He made it known in the town that he would pay the passage and board and give 2,000 piastres to any honest man who would make the voyage with him, upon condition that this man was the most dissatisfied with his state and the most unfortunate in the whole province. Such a crowd of candidates presented themselves that a fleet of ships could hardly have held them. Candide, being desirous of selecting from among the best, marked out about 1/20 of them who seemed to be sociable men, and who all pretended to merit his preference. He assembled them at his inn, and gave them a supper, on condition that each took an oath to relate his history faithfully, promising to choose him who appeared to be most justly discontented with his state, and to bestow some presents upon the rest. They sat until 4 o'clock in the morning. Candide, in listening to all their adventures, was reminded of what the old woman had said to him in their voyage to Buenos Aires, and of her wager that there was not a person on board the ship that had not met with very great misfortunes. He dreamed of Pangloss at every adventure told to him. "Pangloss," said he, "would be hard-pressed to prove his beliefs. I wish that he were here. Certainly, if all things are good, it is in El Dorado, and not in the rest of the world." At length he made choice of a poor man of letters who had worked 10 years for the booksellers of Amsterdam. He judged that there was not in the whole world a trade which could disgust one more. The philosopher was an honest man, but he had been robbed by his wife, beaten by his son, and abandoned by his daughter, who got a Portuguese to run away with her. He had just been deprived of a small employment on which he subsisted, and he was persecuted by the preachers of Suriname, who took him for a Socinian. We must allow that the others were at least as wretched as he, but Candide hoped that the philosopher would entertain him during the voyage. All the other candidates complained that Candide had done them great injustice, but he appeased them by giving 100 piastres to each. Chapter 20. What happened at sea to Candide and Martin. The old philosopher, whose name was Martin, embarked then with Candide for Bordeaux. They had both seen and suffered a great deal, and if the vessel had sailed from Suriname to Japan by the Cape of Good Hope, the subject of moral and natural evil would have enabled them to entertain one another during the whole voyage. Candide, however, had one great advantage over Martin, in that he always hoped to see Miss Cunegonde, whereas Martin had nothing at all to hope. Besides, Candide was possessed of money and jewels, and though he had lost 100 large red sheep, laden with the greatest treasure upon earth, though the knavery of the Dutch skipper still sat heavy upon his mind, yet when he reflected upon what he had still left, and when he mentioned the name of Cunegonde, especially towards the latter end of a repast, he inclined to Pangloss's doctrine. "But you, Mr. Martin," said he to the philosopher, "what do you think of all this? What are your ideas on moral and natural evil?"
"Sir," answered Martin, "our priests accused me of being a Socinian, but the real fact is I'm a Manichaean."
"You jest," said Candide. "There are no longer Manichaeans in the world."
"I am one," said Martin. "I cannot help it. I know not how to think otherwise."
"Surely you must be possessed by the devil," said Candide.
"He is so deeply concerned in the affairs of this world," answered Martin, "that he may very well be in me, as well as in everybody else. But I own to you that when I cast an eye on this globe, or rather on this little ball, I cannot help thinking that God has abandoned it to some malignant being. I accept always El Dorado. I scarcely ever knew a city that did not desire the destruction of a neighbouring city, nor a family that did not wish to exterminate some other family. Everywhere the weak execrate the powerful, before whom they cringe, and the powerful beat them like sheep whose wool and flesh they sell. 1,000,000 regimented assassins, from one extremity of Europe to the other, get their bread by disciplined depredation and murder, for want of more honest employment. Even in those cities which seem to enjoy peace, and where the arts flourish, the inhabitants are devoured by more envy, care, and uneasiness than are experienced by a besieged town. Secret griefs are more cruel than public calamities. In a word, I have seen so much, and experienced so much, that I am a Manichaean."
"Ah, there are, however, some things good," said Candide.
"That may be," said Martin, "but I know them not."
In the middle of this dispute, they heard the report of cannon. It redoubled every instant. Each took out his glass. They saw two ships in close fight about 3 miles off. The wind brought both so near to the French vessel that our travellers had the pleasure of seeing the fight at their ease. At length one let off a broadside, so low and so truly aimed, that the other sank to the bottom. Candide and Martin could plainly perceive 100 men on the deck of the sinking vessel. They raised their hands to heaven and uttered terrible outcries, and the next moment were swallowed up by the sea.
"Well," said Martin, "this is how men treat one another."
"It is true," said Candide. "There is something diabolical in this affair." While speaking, he saw he knew not what of a shining red swimming close to the vessel. They put out the longboat to see what it could be. It was one of his sheep. Candide was more rejoiced at the recovery of this one sheep than he had been grieved at the loss of the 100 laden with the large diamonds of El Dorado. The French captain soon saw that the captain of the victorious vessel was a Spaniard, and that the other was a Dutch pirate, and the very same one who had robbed Candide. The immense plunder which this villain had amassed was buried with him in the sea, and out of the whole only one sheep was saved. "You see," said Candide to Martin, "that crime is sometimes punished. This rogue of a Dutch skipper has met with the fate he deserved."
"Yes," said Martin, "but why should the passengers be doomed also to destruction? God has punished the knave, and the devil has drowned the rest."
The French and Spanish ships continued their course, and Candide continued his conversation with Martin. They disputed 15 successive days, and on the last of those 15 days they were as far advanced as on the first. But however they chatted, they communicated ideas, they consoled each other. Candide caressed his sheep. "Since I have found thee again," said he, "I may likewise chance to find my Cunegonde." Chapter 21 Candide and Martin, reasoning, draw near the coast of France. At length they descried the coast of France. "Were you ever in France, Mr. Martin?" said Candide.
"Yes," said Martin, "I've been in several provinces. In some, one half of the people are fools, in others they're too cunning. In some they're weak and simple, in others they affect to be witty. In all, the principal occupation is love, the next is slander, and the third is talking nonsense."
"But, Mr. Martin, have you seen Paris?"
"Yes, I have. All these kinds are found there. Oh, it is a chaos, a confused multitude, where everybody seeks pleasure and scarcely anyone finds it, at least as it appeared to me. I made a short stay there. On my arrival I was robbed of all I had by pickpockets at the fair of Saint-Germain. I myself was taken for a robber and was imprisoned for 8 days, after which I served as corrector of the press to gain the money necessary for my return to Holland on foot. I knew the whole scribbling rabble, the party rabble, the fanatic rabble. It is said there are very polite people in that city, and I wish to believe it."
"For my part, I have no curiosity to see France," said Candide. "You may easily imagine that after spending a month at El Dorado, I can desire to behold nothing upon earth but Miss Cunegonde. I go to await her at Venice. We shall pass through France on our way to Italy. Will you bear me company?"
"With all my heart," said Martin. "It is said that Venice is fit only for its own nobility, but that strangers meet with a very good reception if they have a good deal of money. I have none of it. You have. Therefore I will follow you all over the world."
"But do you believe," said Candide, "that the earth was originally a sea, as we find it asserted in that large book belonging to the captain?"
"I do not believe a word of it," said Martin, "any more than I do of the many ravings which have been published lately."
"But for what end, then, has this world been formed?" said Candide.
"To plague us to death," answered Martin.
"Are you not greatly surprised," continued Candide, "at the love which these two girls of the Oreillons had for those monkeys, of which I have already told you?"
"Not at all," said Martin. "I do not see that that passion was strange. I have seen so many extraordinary things that I have ceased to be surprised."
"Do you believe," said Candide, "that men have always massacred each other as they do today, that they have always been liars, cheats, traitors, ingrates, brigands, idiots, thieves, scoundrels, gluttons, drunkards, misers, envious, ambitious, bloody-minded, calumniators, debauchers, fanatics, hypocrites, and fools?"
"Do you believe," said Martin, "that hawks have always eaten pigeons when they have found them?"
"Oh, yes, without doubt," said Candide.
"Well, then," said Martin, "if hawks have always had the same character, why should you imagine that men may have changed theirs?"
"Oh," said Candide, "there is a vast deal of difference, for free will..." And, reasoning thus, they arrived at Bordeaux. Chapter 22 What happened in France to Candide and Martin? Candide stayed in Bordeaux no longer than was necessary for the selling of a few of the pebbles of El Dorado, and for hiring a good chaise to hold two passengers, for he could not travel without his philosopher Martin. He was only vexed at parting with his sheep, which he left to the Bordeaux Academy of Sciences, who set as a subject for that year's prize to find why this sheep's wool was red. And the prize was awarded to a learned man of the North who demonstrated by A plus B minus C divided by Z that the sheep must be red and die of the rot. Meanwhile, all the travellers whom Candide met in the inns along his route said to him, "We go to Paris." This general eagerness at length gave him, too, a desire to see this capital, and it was not so very great a detour from the road to Venice. He entered Paris by the suburb of Saint-Marceau and fancied that he was in the dirtiest village of Westphalia. Scarcely was Candide arrived at his inn than he found himself attacked by a slight illness caused by fatigue. As he had a very large diamond on his finger, and the people of the inn had taken notice of a prodigiously heavy box among his baggage, there were two physicians to attend him, though he had never sent for them, and two devotees who warmed his broths. "I remember," Martin said, "also to have been sick at Paris in my first voyage. I was very poor, thus I had neither friends, devotees, nor doctors, and I recovered." However, what with physic and bleeding, Candide's illness became serious. A parson of the neighbourhood came with great meekness to ask for a note of confession for the other world payable to the bearer. Candide would do nothing for him, but the devotees assured him it was the new fashion. He answered that he was not a man of fashion. Martin wished to throw the priest out of the window. The priest swore that they would not bury Candide. Martin swore that he would bury the priest if he continued to be troublesome. The quarrel grew heated. Martin took him by the shoulders and roughly turned him out of doors, which occasioned great scandal and a lawsuit. Candide got well again, and during his convalescence he had very good company to sup with him. They played high. Candide wondered why it was that the ace never came to him, but Martin was not at all astonished. Among those who did him the honours of the town was a little abbé of Périgord, one of those busybodies who are ever alert, officious, forward, fawning, and complacent, who watch for strangers in their passage through the capital, tell them the scandalous history of the town, and offer them pleasure at all prices. He first took Candide and Martin to La Comédie, where they played a new tragedy. Candide happened to be seated near some of the fashionable wits. This did not prevent his shedding tears at the well-acted scenes. One of these critics at his side said to him between the acts, "Your tears are misplaced. That is a shocking actress. The actor who plays with her is yet worse, and the play is still worse than the actors. The author does not know a word of Arabic, yet the scene is an Arabia. Moreover, he is a man that does not believe in innate ideas. And I will bring you tomorrow 20 pamphlets written against him." "Monsieur, how many dramas have you in France?" said Candide to the abbé.
"Oh, 5,000 or 6,000.
"Oh, what a number," said Candide. "How many are good?"
15 or 16,
replied the other. "Oh, what a number," said Martin. Candide was very pleased with an actress who played Queen Elizabeth in a somewhat insipid tragedy sometimes acted. "That actress," said he to Martin, "pleases me much. She has a likeness to Miss Cunegonde. I should be very glad to wait upon her." The Perigordian abbé offered to introduce him. Candide, brought up in Germany, asked what was the etiquette and how they treated queens of England in France.
"Oh, it is necessary to make distinctions," said the abbé. "In the provinces one takes them to the inn. In Paris one respects them when they are beautiful, and throws them on the highway when they are dead."
"Queens on the highway?" said Candide. "Yes, truly," said Martin. "The abbé is right. I was in Paris when Miss Monim passed, as the saying is, from this life to the other. She was refused what people call the honours of sepulture. That is to say, of rotting with all the beggars of the neighbourhood in an ugly cemetery. She was interred all alone by her company at the corner of the Rue du Bourgogne, which ought to trouble her much, for she thought nobly."
"That was very uncivil," said Candide.
"What would you have?" said Martin. "These people are made thus.
Imagine all contradictions, all possible incompatibilities. You will find them in the government, in the law courts, in the churches, in the public shows of this droll nation.
Is it true that they always laugh in Paris? Said Candide. Yes, said the abbé, but it means nothing, for they complain of everything with great fits of laughter. They even do the most detestable things while laughing.
Uh-huh.
Who, said Candide, is that great pig who spoke so ill of the piece at which I wept, and of the actors who gave me so much pleasure?
Oh, he is a bad character, answered the abbé, who gains his livelihood by saying evil of all plays and of all books. He hates whatever succeeds, as the eunuchs hate those who enjoy. He is one of the serpents of literature who nourish themselves on dirt and spite. He is a folliculaire.
What is a folliculaire? Said Candide.
It is, said the abbé, a pamphleteer, a fréron.
Thus Candide, Martin, and the Perigordian conversed on the staircase while watching everyone go out after the performance.
Although I am eager to see Cunegonde again, said Candide, I should like to sup with Miss Clairon, for she appears to me admirable.
The abbé was not the man to approach Miss Clairon, who saw only good company.
She is engaged for this evening, he said, but I shall have the honour to take you to the house of a lady of quality, and there you will know Paris as if you had lived in it for years.
Candide, who was naturally curious, let himself be taken to this lady's house at the end of the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. The company was occupied in playing faro. A dozen melancholy punters held each in his hand a little pack of cards, a bad record of his misfortunes. Profound silence reigned. Pallor was on the faces of the punters, anxiety on that of the banker, and the hostess, sitting near the unpitying banker, noticed with lynx eyes all the doubled and other increased stakes as each player dog's-eared his cards. She made them turn down the edges again with severe but polite attention. She showed no vexation for fear of losing her customers. The lady insisted upon being called the Marchioness of Parolignac. Her daughter, aged 15, was among the punters, and notified with a covert glance the cheatings of the poor people who tried to repair the cruelties of fate. The Perigordian abbé, Candide, and Martin entered. No one rose, no one saluted them, no one looked at them. All were profoundly occupied with their cards.
"The Baroness of Thunder-Ten Tronckh was more polite," said Candide.
However, the abbé whispered to the marchioness, who half rose, honoured Candide with a gracious smile, and Martin with a condescending nod. She gave a seat and a pack of cards to Candide, who lost 50,000 francs in 2 deals, after which they supped very gaily, and everyone was astonished that Candide was not moved by his loss. The servants said among themselves, in the language of servants, "Some English lord is here this evening." The supper passed at first like most Parisian suppers, in silence, followed by a noise of words which could not be distinguished, then with pleasantries of which most were insipid, with false news, with bad reasoning, a little politics, and much evil speaking. They also discussed new books.
"Have you seen," said the Perigordian abbé, "the romance of Sieur Gauchat, Doctor of Divinity?"
"Ah, yes," answered one of the guests, "but I have not been able to finish it. We have a crowd of silly writings, but altogether do not approach the impertinence of Gauchat, Doctor of Divinity. I am so satiated with the great number of detestable books with which we are inundated that I am reduced to punting at faro."
"And the Mélange of Archdeacon Trublet, what do you say of that?" said the abbé.
"Ah," said the Marchioness of Parolignac, "the wearisome mortal! How curiously he repeats to you all that the world knows! How heavily he discusses that which is not worth the trouble of lightly remarking upon! How, without wit, he appropriates the wit of others! How he spoils what he steals! How he disgusts me! But he will disgust me no longer. It is enough to have read a few of the Archdeacon's pages."
There was at table a wise man of taste who supported the Marchioness, They spoke afterwards of tragedies. The lady asked why there were tragedies which were sometimes played and which could not be read. The man of taste explained very well how a piece could have some interest and have almost no merit. He proved, in few words, that it was not enough to introduce one or two of those situations which one finds in all romances, and which always seduce the spectator, but that it was necessary to be new without being odd, often sublime and always natural, to know the human heart and to make it speak, to be a great poet without allowing any person in the piece to appear to be a poet, to know language perfectly, to speak it with purity, with continuous harmony, and without rhythm ever taking anything from sense. Whoever, added he, does not observe all these rules can produce one or two tragedies, applauded at a theatre, but he will never be counted in the ranks of good writers. There are very few good tragedies. Some are idylls in dialogue, well written and well rhymed, others political reasonings which lull to sleep, or amplifications which repel. Others, demoniac dreams in barbarous style, interrupted in sequence with long apostrophes to the gods, because they do not know how to speak to men, with false maxims, with bombastic commonplaces. Candide listened with attention to this discourse, and conceived a great idea of the speaker, and as the Marchioness had taken care to place him beside her, he leaned towards her and took the liberty of asking who was the man who had spoken so well.
Oh, he is a scholar, said the lady, who does not play, whom the abbé sometimes brings to supper. He is perfectly at home among tragedies and books, and he has written a tragedy which was hissed, and a book of which nothing has ever been seen outside his bookseller's shop, excepting the copy which he dedicated to me.
Oh, the great man, said Candide, he is another Pangloss. Then, turning towards him, he said, Sir, you think, doubtless, that all is for the best in the moral and physical world, and that nothing could be otherwise than it is.
"Aye, sir," answered the scholar. "I know nothing of all that. I find that all goes awry with me, that no one knows either what is his rank, nor what is his condition, what he does, nor what he ought to do, and that except supper, which is always gay, and where there appears to be enough concord, all the rest of the time is passed in impertinent quarrels. A Jansenist against Molinist, Parliament against the Church, men of letters against men of letters, courtesans against courtesans, financiers against the people, wives against husbands, relatives against relatives. Oh, it is eternal war.
I have seen the worst, Candide replied, but a wise man, who since has had the misfortune to be hanged, taught me that all is marvellously well. These are but the shadows on a beautiful picture.
Your hanged man mocked the world, said Martin. The shadows are horrible blots.
They are men who make the blots, said Candide, and they cannot be dispensed with.
No, it is not their fault, then, said Martin.
Most of the punters, who understood nothing of this language, drank, and Martin reasoned with the scholar, and Candide related some of his adventures to his hostess. After supper, the Marchioness took Candide into her boudoir and made him sit upon a sofa.
"Ah, well," said she to him, "you love desperately Miss Cunegonde of Thundertentronckh?"
"Yes, madame," answered Candide. The Marchioness replied to him with a tender smile,
"You answer me like a young man from Westphalia. A Frenchman would have said, 'It is true that I have loved Miss Cunegonde, but seeing you, madame, I think I no longer love her.'"
"Alas, madame," said Candide, I will answer you as you wish."
"Your passion for her," said the Marchioness, "commenced by picking up her handkerchief. I wish that you would pick up my garter."
With all my heart," said Candide, and he picked it up.
"But I wish that you would put it on," said the lady.
And Candide put it on.
"You see," said she, "you're a foreigner. I sometimes make my Parisian lovers languish for 15 days. But I give myself to you the first night,
because one must do the honours of one's country to a young man from Westphalia? The lady, having perceived two enormous diamonds upon the hands of the young foreigner, praised them with such good faith that from Candide's fingers they passed to her own. Candide, returning with the Perigordian abbe, felt some remorse in having been unfaithful to Miss Cunegonde. The abbe sympathized in his trouble. He had had but a light part of the 50,000 francs lost at play, and of the value of the 2 brilliants, half given, half extorted. His design was to profit as much as he could by the advantages which the acquaintance of Candide could procure for him. He spoke much of Cunegonde, and Candide told him that he should ask forgiveness of that beautiful one for his infidelity when he should see her in Venice. The abbe redoubled his politeness and attentions, and took a tender interest in all that Candide said, in all that he did, in all that he wished to do.
"And so, sir, you have a rendezvous at Venice?"
"Yes, Monsieur Abbe," answered Candide. "It is absolutely necessary that I go to meet Miss Cunegonde." And then the pleasure of talking of that which he loved induced him to relate, according to his custom, part of his adventures with the fair Westphalian.
"I believe," said the abbe, "that Miss Cunegonde has a great deal of wit, and that she writes charming letters?"
"I have never received any from her," said Candide, "for, being expelled from the castle on her account, I had not an opportunity for writing to her. Soon after that I heard she was dead. Then I found her alive. Then I lost her again. And last of all, I sent an express to her 2,500 leagues from here, and I wait for an answer." The abbe listened attentively, and seemed to be in a brown study. He soon took his leave of the two foreigners after a most tender embrace. The following day Candide received, on awaking, a letter couched in these terms:
"My very dear love, for 8 days I have been ill in this town. I learn that you are here. Ah, I would fly to your arms if I could but move. I was informed of your passage at Bordeaux, where I left faithful Cacambo and the old woman who are to follow me very soon. The governor of Buenos Aires has taken all, but there remains to me your heart. Come, your presence will either give me life or kill me with pleasure."
This charming, this unhoped-for letter transported Candide with an inexpressible joy, and the illness of his dear Cunegonde overwhelmed him with grief. Divided between those two passions, he took his gold and his diamonds and hurried away with Martin to the hotel where Miss Cunegonde was lodged. He entered her room trembling, his heart palpitating, his voice sobbing. He wished to open the curtains of the bed and asked for a light.
"Take care what you do," said the servant-maid. "The light hurts her."
And immediately she drew the curtains again.
"Oh, my dear Cunegonde," said Candide, weeping. "How are you? If you cannot see me, at least speak to me." "She cannot speak," said the maid.
The lady then put a plump hand out from the bed, and Candide bathed it with his tears, and afterwards filled it with diamonds, leaving a bag of gold upon the easy chair. In the midst of these transports, in came an officer, followed by the abbe and a file of soldiers.
"There," said he, "are the two suspected foreigners."
And at the same time he ordered them to be seized and carried to prison.
"Travellers are not treated thus in El Dorado," said Candide.
"I am more a Manichaean now than ever," said Martin.
"But pray, sir, where are you going to carry us?" said Candide.
"To a dungeon,"
answered the officer. Martin, having recovered himself a little, judged that the lady who acted the part of Cunegonde was a cheat, that the Perigordian abbe was a knave who had imposed upon the honest simplicity of Candide, and that the officer was another knave whom they might easily silence. Candide, advised by Martin and impatient to see the real Cunegonde, rather than expose himself before a court of justice, proposed to the officer to give him 3 small diamonds, each worth about 3,000 pistoles.
"Ah, sir," said the man with the ivory baton, "had you committed all the imaginable crimes, you would be to me the most honest man in the world. 3 diamonds! each worth 3,000 pistoles. Sir, instead of carrying you to jail, I would lose my life to serve you. There are orders for arresting all foreigners, but leave it to me. I have a brother at Dieppe in Normandy. I'll conduct you thither, and if you have a diamond to give him, he'll take as much care of you as I would.
And why, said Candide, should all foreigners be arrested?
It is, the Perigordian abbe then made answer, because a poor beggar of the country of Atribati heard some foolish things said. This induced him to commit a parricide, not such as that of 1610 in the month of May, but such as that of 1594 in the month of December, and such as others which have been committed in other years and other months by other poor devils who had heard nonsense spoken.
The officer then explained what the abbe meant.
"Ah, the monsters!" cried Candide. "What horrors among a people who dance and sing! Is there no way of getting quickly out of this country where monkeys provoke tigers? I have seen bears in my country, but men I have beheld nowhere except in El Dorado. In the name of God, sir, conduct me to Venice, where I am to await Miss Cunegonde."
"I can conduct you no further than Lower Normandy," said the officer.
Immediately he ordered his irons to be struck off, acknowledged himself mistaken, sent away his men, set out with Candide and Martin for Dieppe, and left them in the care of his brother. There was then a small Dutch ship in the harbour. The Norman, who by the virtue of 3 more diamonds had become the most subservient of men, put Candide and his attendants on board a vessel that was just ready to set sail for Portsmouth in England. This was not the way to Venice, but Candide thought he had made his way out of hell, and reckoned that he would soon have an opportunity for resuming his journey. Chapter 23. Candide and Martin touch upon the coast of England, and what they saw there.
"Ah, Pangloss, Pangloss! Ah, Martin, Martin! Ah, my dear Cunegonde, what sort of a world is this?" said Candide on board the Dutch ship.
"Something very foolish and abominable," said Martin.
"You know England? Are they as foolish there as in France?"
"It is another kind of folly," said Martin. "You know that these two nations are at war for a few acres of snow in Canada, and that they spend over this beautiful war much more than Canada is worth. To tell you exactly, whether there are more people fit to send to a madhouse in one country than the other is what my imperfect intelligence will not permit. I only know, in general, that the people we are going to see are very gloomy."
Talking thus, they arrived at Portsmouth. The coast was lined with crowds of people whose eyes were fixed on a fine man kneeling, with his eyes bandaged, on board one of the men of war in the harbour. 4 soldiers stood opposite to this man. Each of them fired 3 balls at his head with all the calmness in the world, and the whole assembly went away very well satisfied.
"What is all this?" said Candide. "And what demon is it that exercises his empire in this country?"
He then asked who was that fine man who had been killed with so much ceremony. They answered he was an admiral.
"And why kill this admiral?"
"It's because he did not kill a sufficient number of men himself. He gave battle to a French admiral, and it has been proved that he was not near enough to him."
"But," replied Candide, "surely the French admiral was as far from the English admiral?"
"There is no doubt of it, but in this country it is found good, from time to time, to kill one admiral to encourage the others."
Candide was so shocked and bewildered by what he saw and heard that he would not set foot on shore, and he made a bargain with the Dutch skipper, were he even to rob him like the Surinam captain, to conduct him without delay to Venice. The skipper was ready in 2 days. They coasted France, they passed in sight of Lisbon, and Candide trembled, they passed through the Straits and entered the Mediterranean. At last they landed at Venice.
"Oh, God be praised," said Candide, embracing Martin. "It is here that I shall see again my beautiful Cunegonde. I trust Cacambo as myself. All is well, all will be well, all goes as well as possible."
Chapter 24 Of Paquette and Friar Giroflée. Upon their arrival at Venice, Candide went to search for Cacambo at every inn and coffee-house, and among all the ladies of pleasure, but to no purpose. He sent every day to inquire on all the ships that came in, but there was no news of Cacambo.
"What?" said he to Martin. "I've had time to voyage from Suriname to Bordeaux, to go from Bordeaux to Paris, from Paris to Dieppe, from Dieppe to Portsmouth, to coast along Portugal and Spain, to cross the whole Mediterranean, to spend some months, and yet the beautiful Cunegonde has not arrived. Instead of her, I have only met a Parisian wench and a Perigordian abbé. Cunegonde is dead without doubt, and there is nothing for me but to die. Alas! How much better it would have been for me to have remained in the paradise of El Dorado than to come back to this cursed Europe. You're in the right, my dear Martin. All is misery and illusion."
He fell into a deep melancholy, and neither went to see the opera nor any of the other diversions of the carnival. Nay, he was proof against the temptations of all the ladies.
"You are, in truth, very simple," said Martin to him, "if you imagine that a mongrel valet, who has 5 or 6 millions in his pocket, will go to the other end of the world to seek your mistress and bring her to you to Venice. If he find her, he will keep her to himself. If he do not find her, he will get another. Ah, I advise you to forget your valet Cacambo and your mistress Cunegonde."
Martin was not consoling. Candide's melancholy increased, and Martin continued to prove to him that there was very little virtue or happiness upon earth, except perhaps in El Dorado, where nobody could gain admittance. While they were disputing on this important subject and waiting for Cunegonde, Candide saw a young Teatine friar in St. Mark's Piazza holding a girl on his arm. The Teatine looked fresh and coloured, plump and vigorous. His eyes were sparkling, his air assured, his look lofty and his step bold. The girl was very pretty and sang. She looked amorously at her Teatine and from time to time pinched his fat cheeks. "At least you will allow me," said Candide to Martin, "that those two are happy, hm? Hitherto I have met with none but unfortunate people in the whole habitable globe, except in El Dorado. But as to this pair, I would venture to lay a wager that they are very happy."
"I lay you they are not," said Martin.
"Oh, we need only ask them to dine with us," said Candide, "and you will see whether I am mistaken." Immediately he accosted them, presented his compliments, and invited them to his inn to eat some macaroni, with Lombard partridges and caviar, and to drink some Montepulciano, Lacrima Christi, Cyprus, and Samos wine. The girl blushed. The Teatine accepted the invitation, and she followed him, casting her eyes on Candide with confusion and surprise, and dropping a few tears. No sooner had she set foot in Candide's apartment than she cried out, "Ah, Mr. Candide does not know Paquette again." Candide had not viewed her as yet with attention, his thoughts being entirely taken up with Cunegonde, but recollecting her as she spoke.
"Alas," said he, "my poor child, it is you who reduced Dr. Pangloss to the fine state in which I saw him."
"Alas, it was I, sir, indeed," answered Paquette. "I see that you have heard all. I've been informed of the frightful disasters that befell the family of my lady baroness and the fair Cunegonde. I swear to you that my fate has been scarcely less sad. I was very innocent when you knew me. A grey friar, who was my confessor, easily seduced me. The consequences were terrible. I was obliged to quit the castle some time after the baron had sent you away with kicks on the backside. If a famous surgeon had not taken compassion on me, I should have died. For some time I was this surgeon's mistress, merely out of gratitude. His wife, who was mad with jealousy, beat me every day unmercifully. She was a fury. The surgeon was one of the ugliest of men, and I the most wretched of women to be continually beaten for a man I did not love. You know, sir, what a dangerous thing it is for an ill-natured woman to be married to a doctor? Incensed at the behaviour of his wife, he one day gave her so effectual a remedy to cure her of a slight cold that she died 2 hours after in most horrid convulsions.
The wife's relations prosecuted the husband. He took flight, and I was thrown into jail. My innocence would not have saved me if I had not been good-looking. The judge set me free on condition that he succeeded the surgeon. I was soon supplanted by a rival, turned out of doors quite destitute, and obliged to continue this abominable trade, which appears so pleasant to you men, while to us women it is the utmost abyss of misery. I have come to exercise the profession at Venice. Oh, sir, if you could only imagine what it is to be obliged to caress indifferently an old merchant, a lawyer, a monk, a gondolier, an abbé, to be exposed to abuse and insults, to be often reduced to borrowing a petticoat, only to go and have it raised by a disagreeable man, to be robbed by one of what one has earned from another, to be subject to the extortions of the officers of justice, and to have in prospect only a frightful old age, a hospital, and a dunghill. Oh, you would conclude that I am one of the most unhappy creatures in the world."
Paquette thus opened her heart to honest Candide in the presence of Martin, who said to his friend, "You see that already I have won half the wager." Friar Giroflée stayed in the dining-room and drank a glass or two of wine while he was waiting for dinner. "But," said Candide to Paquette, "you looked so gay and content when I met you. You sang and you behaved so lovingly to the Théatine that you seemed to me as happy as you pretend to be now the reverse."
"Oh, sir," answered Paquette, "this is one of the miseries of the trade. Yesterday I was robbed and beaten by an officer, yet today I must put on good humour to please a friar."
Candide wanted no more convincing. He owned that Martin was in the right. They sat down to table with Paquette and the Théatine. The repast was entertaining, and towards the end they conversed with all confidence.
"Father," said Candide to the friar, "you appear to me to enjoy a state that all the world might envy. The flower of health shines in your face. Your expression makes plain your happiness. You have a very pretty girl for your recreation, and you seem well satisfied with your state as a Théatine."
"My faith, sir," said Friar Giroflée, "I wish that all the Théatines were at the bottom of the sea. I've been tempted 100 times to set fire to the convent and go and become a Turk. My parents forced me at the age of 15 to put on this detestable habit, to increase the fortune of a cursed elder brother whom God confound. Jealousy, discord, and fury dwell in the monastery. It is true I have preached a few bad sermons that have brought me in a little money, of which the prior stole half, while the rest serves to maintain my girls. But when I return at night to the monastery, I am ready to dash my head against the walls of the dormitory, and all my fellows are in the same case."
Martin turned towards Candide with his usual coolness. "Well," said he, "have I not won the whole wager?" Candide gave 2,000 piastres to Paquette and 1,000 to Friar Giroflée.
"I'll answer for it," said he, "that with this they will be happy."
"I do not believe it at all," said Martin.
"You will, perhaps, with these piastres only render them the more unhappy."
"Oh, let that be as it may," said Candide, "but one thing consoles me. I see that we often meet with those whom we expected never to see more, so that perhaps, as I have found my red sheep and Paquette, it may well be that I shall also find Cunigonde."
"I wish," said Martin, "she may one day make you very happy. But I doubt it very much."
"You're very hard of belief," said Candide.
"I have lived," said Martin.
"You see those gondoliers," said Candide. "Are they not perpetually singing?"
"You do not see them," said Martin, "at home with their wives and brats. The doge has his troubles. The gondoliers have theirs. It is true that, all things considered, the life of a gondolier is preferable to that of a doge. But I believe the difference to be so trifling that it is not worth the trouble of examining."
"People talk," said Candide, "of the Senator Pococurante, who lives in that fine palace on the Brenta, where he entertains foreigners in the politest manner. They claim that this man has never felt any uneasiness."
"Oh, I should be glad to see such a rarity," said Martin.
Candide immediately sent to ask the Lord Pococurante permission to wait upon him the next day.